The beginning of Parshas Chukas brings us face to face with the quintessential chukah of the Torah, the mitzvah of Parah Aduma. And there are a number of things that are said about the Parah Aduma. Two of them seem to flatly contradict each other. On the one hand, it is the chukas haTorah. And the definition of a chok is a mitzvah whose reason we don't understand. Those whose job it is to present tamei mitzvos get a free pass because it's acceptable to say we don't know. That said, there is a well-known statement which is actually quoted by Rashi from Chazal in the Medrash, that the Parah Aduma comes as a kapara to atone for the Chet HaEgel. The Parah Aduma is the mother. There's a moshul that is quoted whereby the maidservant, she brought her child to the king's palace, the child made a mess. Who cleans up the mess? The mother. Nowadays the father as well, but also the mother. And Tavo ha'em v'tikaneach tzoas ha'ben. We need to understand how these two statements can live side by side, because as soon as we have defined Parah Aduma as a chok, so we don't know what it's about. We then proceed to say what it does is it comes to be mechaper for the Chet HaEgel. How can we say that in the same setting, having just admitted that we do not really understand what it's about? The truth is that it seems from the Gemara, and certainly from the Medrash, that when we say that Parah Aduma is a mystery, the reference is actually, or specifically, to a certain aspect of the Parah Aduma. In other words, generally we would say it's a chukah, we don't know anything about it, but there's something specifically that is puzzling. And that's really at the epicenter of the Parah Aduma. When Shlomo HaMelech himself says in Koheles, Amarti ech kama v'hi rechoka mimeni, I thought I'd understand, but it's beyond me. He is referring to a specific facet of the Parah Aduma, namely, it contains within it a contradiction. For as we know, the role of the Parah Aduma is to bring tahara to someone who is tamei. A side effect of the Parah Aduma is that it brings tumah to those who are tahor, as the psukim describe. All of the kohanim who are involved in the process, from a certain point onwards, they become tamei. In the condensed formula of Chazal, metaher es hatameim or metamei es hatahorim. If you're tamei, it makes you tahor. If you're tahor, it makes you tamei. So the question, of course, is, well, how can this be? The Parah Aduma, if it's an agent of Tara, how can it also breed, or whatever the correct expression is, Tumah? And it's impossible to work it out. But what's interesting is, from within that mystery lies part of the Kapara for the Chet HaEgel. There is a pasuk in Iyov, in Perek Yud Dalet. The pasuk states, "Mi yitain tahor mitamei." Who can bring out something pure from something impure? Lo echad. No one. That is the pashtus of the pasuk. No one can do that if something is impure and nothing pure can come out of it. Lo echad. But what's interesting is the Medrash in the beginning of Parshas Chukas understands the pasuk slightly differently, for it translates it not as a linear statement, but as a rhetorical question. For of course, there is one who can draw out something pure from impure, and that is the one. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Says the Medrash, "Mi yiten tahor mitamei?" Who can bring out tahara from tuma? Lo echad? Is it not the only one who can do that? And what's very important to realize here is that the reason why the pasuk refers to him as Echad is because were it not to be true that he could bring out Taharah and Tumah, he wouldn't be Echad. And what that means is, it relates to probably one of the oldest problems that people have in relating to the one God, namely, understanding how diverse effects and diverse emanations and even contradictory emanations can all derive from the singular one source. And it's a mistake that many ancient religions made. They were forced to conclude in their analysis that there has to be more than one deity. This is the famous Zoroastrian Persian belief. There must be at least two. And once there's at least two, why stop there? And the truth is, it's almost impossible to understand. Because if we define HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Kulo Tov, how is it possible for something bad to emanate from something good? And the truth is that from a certain point of view, we do relate differently to bad that comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the sense that the Medrash tells us that in the very beginning of light, the creation of light and darkness, and each one had a name given to it. The Pasuk states, Vayikra Elokim Laor Yom, Velachoshech Kara Laila. If we look carefully at that Pasuk, we will see that the HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name, which is the only time it's mentioned in that Pasuk, is mentioned in connection with light. Vayikra Elokim Laor Yom. When it comes to darkness, it does not say Velachoshech Kara Elokim Laila. There is no mention of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name when it comes to darkness. And should we say, if we are sticklers for grammar, that it would be redundant to mention it a second time in the Pasuk? Quite true. But the point is, Choshech should have been mentioned first, because night came before day. So the Pasuk should have said, Vayikra Elokim LaChoshech Laila, V'la'or Kara Yom. It switched the two rounds so that the one and only mention of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name would be associated with good, with light, which is good. And that is why the Medrash says, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu miyached shemo al hara'a. Hashem does not associate his name with evil. And that is the statement that we have with regards to this very mysterious relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and evil. It has to come from him. Because as unpleasant as it is to say that it comes from him, to say the opposite is even worse. And that is why there is a well-known Mishnah in Maseches Brachos, in the 5th Perek, and also in Maseches Megillah, in the 4th Perek, that if a person says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Al HaTov Yizocher Shemecha, may your name be mentioned in conjunction with good, Mishatkin Oso, says the Mishnah. We tell him to be quiet. He's made a grave error. He thinks he said a good thing, because of course he only wants good things to happen. So may your name only be mentioned by good. The implication is that if something evil happens, someone else's name should be mentioned. And therefore, unwittingly, he has fallen into a much more worrying trap than the notion of the existence of evil. For we know that there is a bracha to be made over bad tidings as surely as there's a bracha to be made over good tidings. It's not a bracha that we relish making, but it's a bracha that we can't afford not to make. And the truth is that this is a notion which is underscored every day and every night. For we'll note that in our brachos that precede Kriyat Shema, whatever time of day it is, broadly speaking, if it's the morning or the evening, we will always make reference to the other time frame as coming from the same source. And that is an integral part of the bracha. So we begin in the morning by saying it's the morning time, it's the time of light, we say Yotze Or, it is crucial to mention darkness at a time of light. And the very same thing is true in the evening. In Ma'ariv we say, Barayom, Valaila, Gol Or Mipnei Choshech, Choshech Mipnei Or, Hashem Tzavoko Shemo. And Rabbeinu Yonah in his Perush on the Rif in Maseches Brachos explains that the reason why it's critical to do that is because there were those who ascribed different creators today and tonight for the same reason that good and evil had to emanate from different sources. The moral of the story is that the full meaning of Hashem Echad is the ultimate source of everything, even of contradictory things. As soon as as soon as we would focus on emanations and detach them from the ultimate source, that is the beginning of Avodah Zarah. And that actually, according to the Ramban, was the origins of the Chet HaEgel. When we talk about the Chet HaEgel, the Egel, the calf, is not a random form chosen out of a zoo. The Egel was chosen specifically because the Egel derives from the ox, and the ox is on the left side of the Kisei HaKavod. This is what the Medrash tells us, that when Bnei Yisrael stood at Har Sinai, they had an apprehension of the Kisei HaKavod. And as the Pasuk in Yechezkel describes, every side of the Kisei HaKavod has a different form on it, a different aspect associated with it. And the left side, which is the side of din, of harshness, of justice, is the ox. And that's where the calf comes from. The Jewish people, says Ramban, saw themselves as in a place of din, which of course they were, because they're in the middle of the wilderness. And the definition of the wilderness is you have nothing except what you take with you, which is exactly the definition of Midas HaDin. There is nothing there for you except what you have from yourself. And therefore, they reasoned that the Midah, so to speak, the attribute, the aspect of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's relationship with them that they most need to focus on in order to navigate their way through a place of din is the form of din, Vayetze HaEgel HaZeh. That's how the Chet HaEgel came out. Now, it began as an awareness of this aspect emanating from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Lahavdil, as surely as we could talk about the attribute of justice and the attribute of mercy. However, that was day one. By the time the next day came, it was already Avodah Zarah. Because to give such a physical form to an attribute of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it can begin to be detached from the source and petitioned as its own independent, spontaneous source, which is facilitated by the fact that it's in contradiction to other aspects. And this was the Yesod of the Chet HaEgel. Says Rav Shlomo Fischer, it's very interesting that we have this mystery, it seems to be a gratuitous mystery for us, that the Para Aduma is a contradiction. It is the source of both Tuma and Tara. Just when you think you understand it, it does the opposite. It comes to, people are Tuma, it comes to be bestowed Tara on them. It's an agent of Tara, it's also an agent of Tuma. That's impossible. Mi yitain tahor mi tome. How can we relate to such a thing? How can we understand how it works? The answer is, you can't. This is a lesson in the way to relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Lo echad. The only one that could create something like that is HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. And this is why we say, or more correctly, an aspect of what we mean when we say that the Para Aduma is a kapara for the Chet HaEgel. The mystery of the Para Aduma, which breeds contradictory results, is the beginning of the Tikkun of the Egel, where people were looking to detach results and categorize them and ultimately set them aside from the source themselves. That is the very interesting and, I believe, very thought-provoking comment of Rav Shlomo Fischer. Now, we have to talk about the Mei Meriva, and of course there's a lot to say. And let us begin, of course, by describing what we know about the story. We'll say it in our words and then see where we go from there. Miriam dies. There's no water. Bnei Yisrael are thirsty. They complain. And Moshe is told to speak to the rock. He gathers everyone together. He hits the rock. And somehow that was considered to be a grave error and he suffers for it. Based on this, he is not able to go into Eretz Yisrael. This is not the first time he's been told he can't go into Eretz Yisrael, but it is the last time, meaning this sealed the fate of Moshe to die in the Midbar. And we begin at the beginning because there are a number of important questions that we need to ask. Firstly, we see the results of Moshe hitting the rock. They were a disaster. But why? Why does it make such a difference if Moshe hits the rock as opposed to speaking to the rock? They're both miracles, ultimately. And therefore, how is one considered to be such an illegal act? They both seem to be more or less identical with each other. Secondly, which is the question of the Ramban, the last thing Moshe is able to do, the last thing he wants to do is to hit the rock. It's very interesting that the first thing that he's told to do is to take his staff. That's what we find in Perek Kaf, Pasuk Zayin. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe, kaches hamaseh. And this really is the Ramban's question. Because if the worst thing to do is to hit the rock, so why is he told to take his staff? The implication is, by the way, that he didn't have his staff with him. It would probably be best left where it is, if the thing to be avoided at all costs is hitting the rock. Another interesting question is, he's told to gather everyone, to gather everyone. That's Pasuk Ches, Kacha Samater, Vahakele So'edo. Gather everyone together. Why is it important to gather everyone together? The goal of the exercise here, it seems, is people need water. That's all. If they didn't need water, none of this would have started. So what they need is water. In order to get water, they don't need to be there. They don't need to be all gathered around the rock. The water will pour out, and more or less the way that it did as long as Miriam was alive. So what is the gathering for? Moshe addresses Bnei Yisrael before he hits the rock. And that's in Pasuk Yud. Vayakilu Moshe ba'aron es hakal o pnei hasola. Vayomu lehem. Shimon ha-morim. Listen here. Morim, rebels, teachers, not in the positive sense. Hamin ha-sela ha-zeh notzi lachem mayim. Can we bring water out from this rock? These words need to be understood very carefully, because firstly, what is Moshe achieving by addressing Bnei Yisrael as Morim? And secondly, his question seems to have an answer, because the answer actually is meant to be yes and ultimately was yes. So what's the point of the question? It sounds like a rhetorical question. Shall we bring out water? Was anyone meant to answer at that point? I think if anyone was meant to answer, they'd say yes. Unless it's a rhetorical question. But it's not a rhetorical question, because they were meant to take out water from the rock. So why does Moshe talk about this at all? Now, the Alshech HaKadosh has a very interesting approach to this parsha. And he begins by drawing our attention to the fact that the Jewish people in this episode of Me'Meriva had two problems. And we forget sometimes because the parsha reads in a run. But between the beginning of Chukas and this section of Me'Meriva, 38 years elapsed. Which means that by the time the Jewish people complain that there's no water, they're about to enter Eretz Yisrael, for real. But it doesn't really sound like they're ready. Because when there's no water, they complain. And interestingly, that's the sort of thing they've done before. Moshe never really got angry at them before. But he got angry at them now. Because this is the new generation. These are people that are meant to have learned from 40 years of experience that you should follow the program. Because everyone who didn't is dead. So for Moshe to be met with complaints at this stage is a disappointment that is exponentially greater than anything that's happened so far. And yet, as soon as Miriam dies, there's no hespedim, which is another point that it's always important to remember. Everything that Moshe does today is the day that his sister died, who saved his life, and the only thing that anyone had to say about it was there's no water. I think that's also part of the cheshbon. And Bnei Yisrael come and they complain. It sounds like they haven't learned anything. Sounds like. Which means, says the Alshich, that actually they need two things. They need water, and they also need another lesson in Emunah. They need another booster of awareness that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with them and will take care of them. And neither one of those needs can be negated. And that is why HaKadosh Baruch Hu wishes for them to satisfy both needs at the same time. Namely, number one, they're thirsty, which is not nothing. They need water, and therefore they should get it. The answer is not for them to die of thirst. They should get it. But they also need something else. They need a lesson in emunah, and they should get that also. And the way that they'll get it is if each of them witnesses with his own eyes Moshe Rabbeinu talking to the rock and water coming out. And that's what most people are actually looking for. And they have it. And that's why it's important for them all to see it. That is what's behind the assembly. They need emunah as surely as they need water. Except, logistically, we have an interesting question. Because how many people can crowd around a rock and be able to see it? Not many. We're talking about millions of people. So what's the answer to that? Well, there is an answer. Interestingly, it's mentioned in Rashi. It's from the Medrash. It's Mefurish in Rashi. For Pasuk Yud states, Vayakilu Moshe Ba'aron, Esakahal al-Pnei HaSola. Moshe and Aaron gathered Bnei Yisrael in front of the rock. Now that sounds impossible, says Rashi. It is, under normal circumstances. Ze echad min ha-makomos shehechzik muat es hamaruba. This is one of the places where a small physical place can actually house a great deal more. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu arranged in a miraculous fashion for everyone to be able to see, in a way that defies all the laws of physics, and the closer you get to that world, the more the laws of physics are bent, and sometimes completely ignored. And that's what happened on this occasion. But what's interesting is, it turns out that actually there were two miracles going on. We're just reading Rashi. But there were two miracles going on. The first was the bringing out of the water, which is a miracle. But there's a miracle that happened before that. The fact that everyone was simultaneously able to observe the rock, which is impossible under normal conditions, was the first miracle. Says the Al-Sheikh, that is why Moshe was told to take the staff. Our question was, what is he going to do with the staff? It's only a liability for him. The only thing you could possibly do is to hit the rock, which is a mistake. So why are you telling him to take it? The answer, says the Al-Shir, is Mefurish in the Pasuk. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe in Pasuk Ches, Kach es hamateh vehakel es ha'idah. Take the mateh. What for? To hit the rock? No, not to hit the rock. To assemble the people. You'll need the matter to assemble the people, because that's also a miracle. And these miracles have always been performed by the matter. It's the osos. That's what it's for. And that's what Moshe did. Now, so far, we've understood the role of the matter. The matter, in a sense, is really more for the benefit of the people, to allow them to each one witness the miracle. But the miracle itself should take place by Moshe speaking. And yet, Moshe hits the rock as well. And the question is, why? So the Al-Sheikh explains that Moshe is well aware, and we've seen it in the past, that his ability to act is very often directly proportionate to the level of the Jewish people. When the Jewish people fall, so does Moshe. When they fell at the Egel, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe, Lech Reit, you go down. When they go down, you go down. Rashi says, Reit migdulascha. All of your greatness is connected to them. And your abilities, to a certain degree, are a function of their stature. And if that's the case, then the Moshe understands, or Moshe judges, that his ability to act and perform the higher level of miracle, and for us, they're both out of our stratosphere, but there is a qualitative difference between speaking to the rock and hitting the rock, the higher level is only possible if the Jewish people are on the higher level. Then Moshe can act at his highest. But if they fall short, then maybe Moshe will fall short. And this brings the specter of a disaster. Because the only thing worse than Moshe hitting the rock, which will work, even Moshe understands this is a fallback option that he's more or less confident in, but the only thing that's worse than hitting the rock when he should have spoken to it is speaking to the rock when he shouldn't have spoken to it. If the Jewish people aren't ready and he speaks to the rock and nothing happens, that's a chilul Hashem. So Moshe is stuck, in a sense, because it doesn't look like the Jewish people are able to finance a greater miracle. And Moshe doesn't know if he can do it by himself. Perhaps this is one of those occasions where he is a function of the level of the Jewish people. And he looks at them, and they're rowdy, and they're grumbling. And that is why he says to them, Shimuno Hamorin. He talks to them in this way, Haminasela hazen otilachamayim. Can we bring out water? What does he mean by that? What he means is that given your Morim state, given your rebellious state, I'm not sure what our options are. Do you think we can do everything that I've been told to do? It's up to you as well. And Moshe judges that the Jewish people are not on a level that would allow him to take out water from the rock by speaking to it. And he takes the safer option and he hits. Now, the question is, well, that was a mistake. But if it's a mistake, then Moshe should have known. But how could Moshe have known? How should Moshe have known that he will be able, if he follows instructions, he will be able. He doesn't need to be safe. He can go for the higher level. How does he know that? The answer, says the Al-Sheikh, of course, we are with the Al-Sheikh in hindsight. But the answer is that with everything going on, Moshe should have remembered that everything that's happening with the rock is being made visible to each and every one of the Jewish people in a miraculous way. Because that's what's happening as a result of the matter. They're all assembled, everyone can see the rock. That means HaKadosh Baruch Hu is providing a miracle in order to allow them to see what's happening. And we have a principle. Lo Ovid Kud Shabarichu Nisa L'Shikra. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will not go out of his way, so to speak, to perform a miracle for a bad outcome. In other words, if it looks like it's going to be a disaster, so the first thing that would happen is the network coverage that HaKadosh Baruch Hu supplied for everyone for the rock would have stopped. Because they're about to witness a disaster. The very fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is maintaining them in a way that each person can see clearly what's happening in the rock, that should have been an indication to Moshe that you can proceed. It's guaranteed. It will work. It's underscored. For one of two reasons. Either fundamentally, they are on the level, or perhaps alternatively, even if they're not, that doesn't need to hold you back. And that is why, when Moshe hits the rock, again, easy for us to talk, we just need to try and understand. For Moshe, it's all happening at once. But when HaKadosh Baruch Hu upbraids Moshe, he says in Yud Beis, Vayomer Hashem, this is Perek Kaf Pasuk, Yud Beis, Vayomer Hashem al Moshe vel Aaron, Yan lo e'emantem bi, because you did not he'emantem, promote emuna for me, lakdisheni, to sanctify my name, le'enei b'nei Yisrael. Those are the critical words, says the Al-Sheikh. In other words, everyone was seeing, and they were only seeing because I allowed them to see. You should have known that I wouldn't have allowed them to see if it was going to work out badly. And that is the main Meriva, according to the Al-Sheikh. I feel, perhaps, this is with all the reservations that are correct to say, but perhaps there may be something else that could be explained here. And that is, Moshe is told that as a result of what happened here, he can't go into Eretz Yisrael. As we mentioned before, this is not the first time that Moshe has been told that. And in fact, in Sefer Devarim, we will find out that already from the time of the Meraglim, it seems, from the Chet of the Meraglim, it is already looming over Moshe that he will not be able to go into Eretz Yisrael. Because when he chastises the Jewish people for the Chet of the Meraglim, he says, Gambi hisanach Hashem beglalchem. Hashem also got angry at me and said, you will not go into Eretz Canaan, which is interesting, because we don't know that yet. In Parshas Chukas, the first we hear of it openly is that because he hit the rock, he can't go in. But Moshe says later on, the truth is it was already in the wings from the time of the Meraglim. If that's true, then it sounds like the sentence was, so to speak, suspended over Moshe until it was precipitated by the hitting of the rock. The hitting of the rock was the makkah bepatish of the sentence that had already been initiated. But the question is, it was the final blow? How are these two things connected? How is the hitting of the rock connected to the Chet HaMeraglim? They have nothing to do with each other. But it could be, according to the Al-Sheikh, they do, because, in a sense, if natural justice, so to speak, says that Moshe has to die in the Midbar, even though he is not at fault for the Meraglim, but he's the leader of the Jewish people, and therefore he has to share their fate, because the manhig is lefi hador. That's why he very naturally comes under the shadow of the Meraglim, because if the whole generation is destined to die, and he is their leader, so naturally the leader goes to the people. He is tied to the people. From a certain point of view, the only way Moshe can now enter Eretz Canaan is if he pulls away from the Jewish people, as if to say he is able to act in a level which is not held back by the Jewish people. One could say that that is what he should have done when he hit the rock, because he should have spoken to the rock, even though he judges that the Jewish people aren't worthy to have that miracle done. But if he feels that he doesn't always need to be held back by the limitations and the shortcomings of the Jewish people, then if he was told to speak to the rock, he should be able to do that, notwithstanding their lower madrega. But at that point, Moshe said, I can't. If that's their level, I'll be held back by them. And the result of that is that he was held back by them, which is the natural outcome of the Meraglim, and wasn't able to put away. That's right. So that, I think, is...
Mefarshim say that the reason Moshe didn't enter Eretz Yisrael is not hitting the rock, because he spoke Shimon HaMorim.
Yes.
He spoke harshly to the Jewish people. They were thirsty. He should have given him water.
Right.
I mean, you don't speak to people who are, you can't be in anger.
Right.
So Shimon, it's not really hitting the rock, but it's a...
That is an approach. That's the approach of the Rambam. If we try to cater for all approaches, it will take us 40 years, I think. But
also, Aaron didn't enter. Aaron also didn't enter as well.
We're going to have to leave Aaron for next year.
Is that because of the Medaglia?
Yes. Okay. Now, what's interesting is, after the Meimariva, the very next thing that happens is a delegation is sent, which is in Perek Kaf Pasuk Kaf Beis. Pardon me. It's in Perek Kaf Pasuk Yudalad. Vayishlach Moshe Malachim Mikodesh. Moshe sends messengers from Kodesh El Melech Edom to the king of Edom, because they're basically, they're Erev entry into Eretz Yisrael. They're about to come in from the east side. And the ones who are in their way are Edom. And the Jewish people have no quarrel at this stage or in this capacity with Edom. And therefore it's a peaceful mission. Ko'amar Achicha Yisrael. He gives them a little bit of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, just to fill him in on the background, and asks to go to pass through the land unmolested. We won't harm you, you don't harm us. And the king of Edom refuses. Okay. What's interesting is, there are two missions, there are two delegations that are sent to the inhabitants of Eretz Canaan in one form or another in this week's Parsha. Here to Edom, at the end of the Parsha to Sichon. And what's interesting is, if we have a look at who sent them, in Pasuk Yudalet it says, Vayishlach Moshe Malachim. Moshe sends Malachim. Now, who is Moshe? He's a leader of the Jewish people. When it says he sent them, it means the Jewish people sent them. However, we should note that this is in contrast to the end of the parasha, which is Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Aleph, where it says, Vayishlach Yisrael Malachim El Sichon Melech HaEmori. So the question is, and who is Yisrael? I mean, Yisrael is obviously with Moshe at the helm. There are two ways of saying the same thing, but they're two different things. So the question that the Mefarshim are very interested in is, why is it that the first mission was sent by Moshe and the second one was sent by Yisrael? And Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz gives two very interesting answers, quite different from each other. The first is, and this I think it's a very sobering point, because the news, the fallout from the Meimariva, from Moshe hitting the rock, was tragic news for Moshe. It's tragic news for the whole of the Jewish people. It could be that this was the first they heard, as certainly as a finality, that Moshe would not be coming with them to Eretz Yisrael. That's it. Now, and this is the Dor HaChadash. And Moshe will not be coming with them. So now the question is, how eager will they be now to make their way into Eretz Canaan, knowing that the quicker they get there, the quicker they'll lose Moshe Rabbeinu? And that is why no one was in a hurry to do anything. It's a very torn situation. Because you, of course, ultimately you want to go forward, but who's going to take the first step forward? Every step forward is a step away from Moshe Rabbeinu. And no one was doing anything until Moshe did it. This delegation to Edom was their first step into Eretz Yisrael, and no one wanted to take that first step and leave Moshe behind. And Moshe says, I'm not going into Eretz Canaan, but you need to, and we need to get things started, and he is the one that sends the messengers. It's very interesting. But there's another accompanying point of Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz. It's interesting to read these psukim. If you haven't seen them in a while, or maybe never thought about them, what we're describing is the people that are closest to them are Edom. Edom, in our terminology, is Esav. Now, geographically, they are the closest. Statistically, they are the furthest in terms of actually having any chance of acceding or agreeing to an amicable passage of the Jewish people through their land. Because really, in one sentence, what happened is the Jewish people are saying to the descendants of Esav, the nation of Esav, we'd like, if you don't mind, to come into Eretz Canaan. Would you please step aside? We won't bother you, and you don't bother us. How does that sound? Well, the answer was forthcoming from Melech Edom, and he said, no. There's no way that that's going to happen. And he even came out and with a show of arms, and the Jewish people left him alone. And there must have been a lot of the Jewish people who were saying, well, I could have told you that would happen. We're talking about Esav. This is Edom. That entire delegation was a malacha shein tzricha legufa. It's a complete waste of time. No one thought to do that. Because that's never going to happen. He'll never say yes. Says Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz, there's only one person who thought it was worth a try. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. And the reason why is because of the events of Meimariva. The pasuk says, "Vayishlach Moshe Malachim miKodesh." He sent Malachim from Kodesh. Now, Kodesh is not just a geographical location, because we know that they're there and they haven't moved. He sent Malachim from Kodesh means he learned from the events of Kodesh. Al tihi maflig lechol dover. You never know. Because Moshe, a few moments ago, was certain that the Jewish people were not in a madrega that could finance the miracle of speaking to the rock. But that's a mistake. He dismissed it as impossible to his great loss. And therefore, by this stage, that everyone is looking at Edom and saying, that will never work. So Moshe says, that's what I said about you. And I suffered for it. So we should try it. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
That's what they said about who?
That's what he said about them. Two very interesting comments of Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz. And it's also interesting to consider the fallout. Because, once again, of the two delegations, we have Edom. They send to Edom, and Edom says no, and comes out with a show of arms, and the Jewish people leave them alone. Vayet Yisrael may love. They back down and leave them alone. The next delegation is to Sichon, and the wording of the offer is almost exactly the same. Nabra nava artzecha, let us go through your land. Baderech hamelech nelech, lo nite yaminu smol. And Sichon comes out to war, and they go out to war, and they destroy him. Sichon melech ha'emori. What's interesting is, the Pasuk in Sefer Devarim, in Chumash Devarim, Perek Beis Pasuk Lamed, describes the war as saying that Sichon did something that was foolish. He lived in fortified cities, and they're looking to enter into his land. If they're looking to come to you, and where you are is fortified, so why on earth would you leave your fortifications, expose yourself, and go out to them? Well, the way the Pasuk puts it is, Ki hikshoh Hashem es rucho, Hashem hardened his spirit, ve'imetz les levovo, and strengthened his heart, lemantito beyodcho, in order to deliver him into your hands. Which is very interesting, because this is a lesser known example of the hardening of someone's heart. We always associate that with Paro, which happened over a course of a long time. And it happened again with Sichon. That's what the Pasuk says. Hashem hardened his heart. There is no explanation as to why he would leave his fortifications and come and wage war against you in the desert where you are. Hashem hardened his heart. Says the Sefer Ikrim, which is one of the classic Sifrei Machshava from the Rishonim, Rabbi Yosef Albo, in the Mama Haravi. And I think it's a chizuk for an approach that we have taken already now for a number of years, that when we talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu hardening someone's heart, it does not necessarily refer to reaching into their heart and switching on or off a dial or a knob or a switch. But it refers to presenting them with a version of events that if their pride or power mania or anything else will cause them to interpret that in a way that will lead them to act in a certain way, so be it. Bela'az, we would say, pushing their buttons. And the truth is, people do that to each other the whole time. It's just not spoken about in the Bible. That's what it means for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to harden someone's heart. And therefore, as we've spoken many times, when Hashem hardened Paro's heart, that means that he gave him loops within the Makos, that if you're fixated and you refuse to see reason, you'll translate that to say that next time around you'll win. Which for us is demented, but for Paro was perfectly reasonable. There is no supernatural process which is going on here. It is the very natural human trait of interpreting reality the way which is convenient for you. And if you are naturally proud, which the emperor of Egypt is likely to be, so you have trouble. How did Hashem harden Sichon's heart? What did he do? The answer, says the Ikrim, is that's what the delegation to Edom is all about. The delegation to Edom, which was actually a failure in a sense, because here's the Jewish people, they've been apparently accompanied by miracles for the last 40 years. They should be set to just stomp through wherever they please and no one can stand in their way, but apparently they don't do that. They send a message, and when the answer is no, they back down. That's very strange. That doesn't sound to be the invincible people that we've been taught to fear. They asked for permission, and when it was denied, they got scared. And he went out to meet them with arms, and they backed away. So Sichon, if he can do it, I can do it, because I'm Sichon. And thus, a king and his fortress are parted. Says the Pasuk, Hashem hardened his heart. It's all natural. It's just a question of interpretation of events. But if you're Sichon, it is your undoing. Because by that time he had as little chance of staying within his fortifications as if Hashem really had switched off something in his heart. That's the way it works. Now, I'd like to conclude by referring to the partner in crime of Sichon, and that is Og Melech HaBashan. We always mention them together. And the Gemara actually speaks at length about Og. Og is actually even responsible for a halacha, because the Mishnah tells us in the beginning of the ninth parak of Maseches Brachos that if a person sees certain miraculous sights or objects, there are brachas to be made. If they are connected to miracles, associated with miracles, there's a bracha. Baruch she'asa nisim la'avaseinu b'makom hazeh. If he sees the place where the Jewish people cross through the Yam Suf, he makes a bracha. And one of the places is, says the Mishnah, if he sees the rock of Og, Even shebikesh Og melech haboshan lashlich al Yisrael, he makes a bracha, because that was a miraculous defeat. And how did it work? So the Gemara explains. Og, who was a giant, so he looks at the Jewish people. They are 3 parsa by 3 parsa, which is a certain measurement, 12 kilometers by 12 kilometers, approximately. So, he goes, he uproots a mountain, Okartura uproots a mountain, and holds it over his head, ready to throw it on them. At that point, I'm sure you've heard the story, at that point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings ants, a troop of ants, and they get to work on the mountain, and they burrow into the mountain until it crumbles, and it crumbles over his head. At that point, Og is no longer able to throw it effectively, and therefore he wishes to remove it. But he's unable to do so, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu then arranges for his teeth to grow out into the mountain. And therefore they are embedded in the mountain, he's unable to remove it. So here we have Og standing with a mountain over his head, cannot remove it, and that's where things are currently. At that point, Moshe comes. Moshe, says the Gemara, is 10 amos tall. He has an axe in his hand that is 10 amos long. He jumps up a distance of 10 amos, which gives us a subtotal. I arranged not to be quoting a pasuk at this stage this time. That gives us a total of 30 amos. And he hits Og in the ankle, and Og dies. And that is the end of Og Melech HaBoshan. Ve'ein ha-gemora hazos omeres ela darsheni. Of course, as we know, there are many questions. There are increasing numbers of questions that could be asked with regards to this. First of all, we know that Og is not that big. When the Pasuk describes him when he was a child, and assuming that at least proportionately as an adult, so let's call him 50 amos tall or something like that, his ankle is not going to be 30 amos above the ground. It's not going to be. Aside from the fact that if he's hit in the ankle, even if he's hit very hard in the ankle, it's not going to kill him. I mean, Og preceded the invention of the Achilles heel. And therefore, to be hit in the ankle, that doesn't kill Og. Etc., etc. And therefore, we need to really understand what is being communicated to us within this story. We preface with the words of the Rambam in his introduction to his Perush on the Mishnah, who talks about agodos, which for us, we're used to them. Agodos, very difficult to know how to translate them, very easy to mistranslate them. Agodos are really just defined negatively as the non-halachic part of Torah Shebaal Peh. That's what they are. To call them stories or legends is a disservice. For they're there for a reason. But what do we make of the fact when the Gemara or the Medrash describes all of these supernatural occurrences and unusual things within the Agoda? So the Rambam says there are 3 groups, there are 3 approaches, and 2 of them have it drastically wrong, and the 3rd one is almost not patronized by anyone, but that's the right approach. Some people take everything literally, and they think that it's correct to take it literally, and the more literally you take it, the better a Jew you are. And the Rambam says, unfortunately, they're missing the point. That's not what Chazal meant at all. There are others who think that the stories are literal, and they don't believe them, and they like it that way, says the Rambam, because that allows them to ridicule the Agodas, because, of course, it couldn't be literal, but it doesn't occur to them that Chazal didn't mean them literally, and therefore they were in the Dark Ages, we understand much better, and the moral of the story is, so don't talk to me about Agoda. And the reason why they like to do that is because the more they can lower the meaning of the Agodas, the less threatened they are by them. Because as long as it's story, everyone likes stories. Everyone likes the rabbi to tell a story. Stories never hurt anyone. Stories never demanded anything of anyone, and if it doesn't make any sense, all the better, because then certainly no one can claim that I have to become a better person as a result of this story. It doesn't even make sense. And therefore, this is a way of keeping the call of the Agoda at arm's length. And people do that until today. It is actually a full-time hobby. And the third approach, says the Rambam, are people who understand that what Chazal are doing when they refer to certain occurrences is they are looking to communicate a message via a moshel. And should you say, says the Rambam, what a strange idea to communicate a deep idea via a moshel, says the Rambam, Shlomo HaMelech apparently thought it wasn't such a strange idea at all. He wrote a sefer called Mishlei, and he was the wisest person who ever lived. So, you know where Chazal got it from. Now, if that's the case, the Rambam himself wrote that he was planning on writing a sefer explaining the Agadot, because obviously there are certain things that are to be taken literally. The trick is to know, to find the balance. What yes, what no. The Rambam had plans to write a sefer, which unfortunately never happened. But each Agada we take as it comes, it's important to ask ourselves, what does the Agada want from me? What is it telling me about my life? The Rashba here, who has a very slim volume of Chidushei Agados, really just a dozen or so Agados that I believe that he talks about, and this is one of them, and he explains that the first thing that we need to know about this Agada of Og Melech HaBashan is that its background is in another Agada. And that's also very important in terms of how Agadas work. Very often the Agada is a piece in the picture. It is not the entire picture. This Agada actually has a prologue. And the prologue is that Og has a bit of a history with the Jewish people, because according to Chazal, Og is the palit. He is the refugee who came from the Sodom and Amorah, Vayavo HaPalit. He came to Avram to tell him that Lot had been captured. Now, interestingly and amazingly, this was considered to be a merit for him. Because although he didn't mean it well, because he actually thought that if Avram went to war, he'd be killed, which is really what everyone thought, and according to the Medrash, even what Avram thought. And once Avram is killed, so then Og can marry Sarah. So that's called Shelo Lishma. That said, it had a good outcome, and he is accredited with some of it, because nothing ever goes to waste. Og, of course, has a grossly distorted perception of just what a good deed he did. And what we also find very often is that people who have very little to say for themselves in terms of merits tend to get paid off much more quickly. Nebuchadnezzar became the king of the world, as far as Chazal is concerned, because he took three steps in honor of God. When the king sent a letter to Chizkiyahu saying, for Chizkiyahu and for the God of Israel, and Nebuchadnezzar says, you shouldn't put a king before God, and he ran to reclaim the letter, that was a merit for him. It's three steps. That's why we take three steps backwards after Shemoneh Esrei, and that's at the point that we daven for the binyan of the Beis HaMikdash. Because our three steps are looking to counter his three steps that destroyed them. Now, if that's true for Nebuchadnezzar, three steps makes you king of the world, so the steps that Og took are a schus for him, and credit comes very quickly for people like that in this world. They only exist in terms of this world, so that's where their payback comes. A mountain, says the Rashba, is a way that we find the Navi refers to the Avos. Habitu al tzur chutzavtem, see the mountain that you are hewn from. That's Avram Avinu, Habitu al Avram Avichem. The notion of Og uprooting a mountain and holding it over his head is the idea of Og cashing in on the mountain of Avram. And even though he is not on that level, but he is attached to someone who is, and he's looking for a reward. He's looking to cash in on that. So he picks up the mountain. When, of course, the mountain is the equivalent of all the Jewish people because everyone comes from Avram. He holds it over his head in a way to act and use it against the Jewish people. What happens at this stage? It says the Gemara, Kodesh Baruch Hu, destroys the mountain, destroys the way he wants to use it via ants. What is an ant? An ant is very interesting because it's much smaller than a mountain. But with enough ants and enough time and enough persistence, it can destroy the mountain. The ants, says the Rashba, are the Jewish people. Because they're not always the most numerous, and they're not always physically the strongest. But HaKol Kol Yaakov, they have a certain power that they have to use in conjunction with other things, but they dare not neglect, which is the power of tefillah. And they are the ant because they can eat through something with their mouth, which is much harder than they are. And indeed, the mountain collapses, because the schus of the Jewish people, the tefillahs of the Jewish people, at that stage, on that occasion, countered the mountain of oak, and it fell over his head, meaning it is not working for him. The question is, now what happens? Well, says the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh, in the end of this week's Parsha, the Gemara told us that Og's teeth grew into the mountain. He tried to remove it, but his teeth wouldn't let him. The teeth of a Rasha, says Maharal, are a reference to the instinctual, predatory and aggressive nature of a Rasha that defies reason. They are the fangs of the Rasha. And now consider the following. Og is at a point where he realizes that if he proceeds, he understands his mountain has fallen over his head. It is not working for him. If he goes forward, he will lose. And reason dictates, get rid of the mountain and go home. And that's what a certain part of him is looking to do. But there's another part of him that is locked into his action against the Jewish people. His teeth grow out and do not allow him to remove the mountain. And that is something that was not the last time that has happened. Anyone who is aware of the events of the end of the Second World War, when Germany is losing on all fronts and Hitler, Yamach Shemo, is pulling everyone into the camps. Because his teeth have grown into the mountain. His desire to destroy the Jewish people was stronger than his desire for self-preservation. And that remains true till today, closer to home. And so here's Og, he's locked in. Enter Moshe. Moshe is 10 Amos. What does that mean? The number 10, of course, is the number of Shlemus. That means that here we have the counter merits on this occasion. You have the merit of Moshe Rabbeinu, leader of the Jewish people. He is Eser. He is 10 Amos. His acts is 10 Amos. The Navi always describes the people that a person is in charge of as they are their tool. Kechli b'yad ha-yotzer. And the Jewish people also, they have a fundamental degree of Shlemus. The acts that Moshe wields is also 10 Amos long. And the Jewish people also have the schus of the Avos. Moshe jumps up back. When you jump upwards, you jump backwards. He's also looking to partake of the schus of Avraham Avinu. And all of this colludes together to allow him to deliver a fatal blow to Og in the ankle. And the reason why Og is killed by a blow to the ankle is because he was looking to cash in on the running with his feet. By Avoa Palit, by Egel Avraham Ivri. That was his card, but it worked against him. Once that was disabled, he was finished. That's the biur of the Agoda. And what's interesting is, says the Rashba, especially in this occasion, when we talk about allegory and we talk about literal, in this event, the Mishnah spoke about the rock of Og, and the Gemara told us about the mountain of Og. Because there is no question that there is a physical object called the rock of Og. I mean, you have to be seeing something to make the bracha. Og was physically very strong, and he was enlisting these unusually large missiles to project against the Jewish people. But the background to how he thought this would work is the mountain of Og that is spoken about. There's a great deal to discuss about Agodas, but I think for at least as something to think about, to raise the question, why are Agodas presented in this way? Why did the Gemara not say what the Rashba said? Why did the Gemara not explain to us conceptually what is happening, the way the Rashba unraveled what the Gemara is referring to allegorically? And I'm sure there are many answers to this question, but the one that is most meaningful for me is that in order for Agodas, which are meant to impact on the way a person thinks about things and feels about things, as is always true in Torah, you cannot compare the way you feel and think about that whole episode, the way it's explained to you conceptually, and the way that it's portrayed to you allegorically. You cannot compare the appreciation of tefillah that a person has, if it's portrayed to you as ants eating through a mountain, which is a very graphic and poignant image, as opposed to the conceptual, the Jewish people are effective in their power of prayer. You cannot compare the depiction of the hatred that a person can have, an anti-Semitic person can have for the Jewish people, when his teeth go out into a mountain and he is physically unable to remove it from his head. There's nothing else you could say that would do justice to that. But the Agoda is closer, because essentially that's what it is. So it's interesting, because every Agoda begins with an outer shell. And then you peel back the shell, tapuche zohar b'maskeos kesev. You peel back the silver coating in order to get to the gold inside. But I think part of the irony of Agodas is that actually it is the outer layer of the Agoda that affects you inside. Because the inner message of the Agoda, the cognitive message, you deal with cognitively, possibly externally. But the outer shell, the outer casing, which is the imagery, is really what affects, goes further than the understanding of the Agoda, and ultimately that's where the Agoda is meant to reach, in order to make us better people, as we've quoted the Chacham many times, not just information, but also transformation. We'll leave it over there.
Thank you.